Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Arlen Hess. Arlen Hess is a lecturer at Washington and Jefferson College, where she teaches literature and writing. She received her MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts, and her work has appeared in the Pittsburgh Quarterly, 31st Bird Review, Connotation Press, The Literary Bohemian, and the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology. She was the founding editor of the Pittsburgh literary journal, Paper Street. And she has a manuscript of poems which is entitled The Etymology of Autumn. Hi, Arlen.
Hi, Jan.
How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really overdue, and we should have had you a long time ago, so I'm really happy you're here.
It's an honor. It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Okay, so you're going to start with some poems from your manuscript.
I am. I'm going to start with a brand new one called The Trees Agree. Not sure I'm happy with this title, but that's where it is for today. From my desk, I hear the sycamores on the corner. Their hard brown leaves sound like rain hitting my neighbor's roof for the first time since August. They cling to branches with determined charm, warning of storms yet to come. When I realize it's only trees, I turn my back to the window and face my work. It is only at a distance I am fooled by their gossip. I pass them most nights when I walk Cleo across the intersection, never thinking twice about the winter they portend. If I listen hard enough, I think I can hear in them the frustrations of my neighbors, a family of six on the corner, their four daughters running barefoot across the yard into the street on the 4th of July, the retirees in the shuttered brick house who load guns into their station wagon on weekends and ask me if I work my beagle, the single man who moved in with his girlfriend 3 years ago, then remained 6 months later when she moved out. Despite the disappointments that float above the neighborhood, the trees revive their September ritual. Close to the street, my front bushes collect used tissues, empty Red Bull cans, burger wrappers from teenagers on their way home from school. Scandalous how our waste defines us. Dog hair littering the floor when we abandon our homes. Spinach rotting in the crisper. Crusts of leaves howling in the wind. This is another autumn poem. It's called September, and it's modeled after Robert Haas's poem, Happiness. Because yesterday, when I drove into the city, a young man with red hair played saxophone outside the art museum, so I shut off the radio and rolled down the window to listen until the light turned green, although he never looked up, and I couldn't drop a dollar into his velvet-lined case. Such is the momentary consolation of kindness. And because this morning in the doorway of the kitchen, I burned old letters, the blue glow of the match catching the folded corner of the envelope, each loop and hyphen consumed until thick paper, too much for the meager flame, vowed the postmark of our breakup would remain. The slow pulse of traffic outside, like a rumor of waves, offering the irony of tide to winter bathers on shore, the fitful drone of the refrigerator, like a dog searching for a corner to guard against the roll call of hunger. Always the trappings of time are watching. And because later, driving home from work, I blinked away the afternoon sun reflected in the side mirror of the pickup truck ahead of me, the pale yellow of the coming winter, like celebrity, leaving a blind spot of obsession on my left eye, I thought, satisfaction. Like a secret well kept, only what we swear to in childhood we know to be true. This is another modeled poem from Marie Howe, from her book, What the Living Do. And it's also a little bit about childhood. I ended the last one on a childhood note, and I'm going to pick that up. It's called Orphan Stew. It was soup made from bark and onion grass mixed with water in a white enameled stock pot with blue lip and handles. My mother let me and my friends take turns simmering over a rock circle and invisible flame at the base of our front maple. Most of us were too young to cook for real, though we'd studied mothers and grandmothers stirring pots, looking at the range, adjusting the heat, stirring, looking again. Anne devised the plot. She was 3 years older. Five girls, escaped from an orphanage and cruel matron, live by their wits in the cold PA woods. She'd stand over us, buttoned to her dimples, in a plaid wool coat, directing the action, telling us what to say, when to fight, describing to us our motivation as if we understood every four-syllable word she said. This was her game. We were her actors. Real trust and belief when we performed for her. All summer we thrived, collected rocks and branches, leaves left over from last year's fall. Knelt at the tree where the stew was, like believers in the desert, imitating the life that went on without us, so we could say we lived there. And this is a poem about my junior high years. And it's called Magnolia. She made phone call after phone call from my mother's kitchen close to midnight and passed the receiver to each of us in pajamas, still bloated from pizza and cake, having celebrated my ascent into adolescence, until we heard the wife of our social studies teacher beg us to let their infant daughter, wailing in the background, go back to sleep. And we hung up the phone and laughed until we cried. Someone asked what life had been like in South Carolina, and Helen described Sunday morning grits, long walks to church, shooting lessons by the river for her older brother, Mitchell, almost old enough to drive. One afternoon behind the library, I watched him punch a boy in our grade. Thick mucus from the victim's nose exploded with a red smack as it hit the ground, a surprise calm shuddering through me like a childhood promise broken. That spring, I let Kelly wait for hours in the schoolyard while I snuck out with Helen for a slice and a Coke, all of us unaware of the connection between the first blood I saw and the first blood I drew.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Arlen Hess, and she's reading from her manuscript, The Etymology of Autumn. Arlen, one thing I really like about your poems is there's a sense of steadiness and sort of an inherent feeling of organization in your poems.
Yes, probably too much so.
No. And people can't see this, but I have some poems in front of me. A really dependable sense of line, and you have your poems are in the form of couplets, tercets, quatrains. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your process and your relationship to form?
Yes. I'm going to read a poem later that is totally fractures that. But most of my life I have tried to write with a strong sense of line and stanza. I find that I return a lot to the couplet. It's almost a pure form of stanza. And then from that, I build into tercets and quatrains.
What do you mean a pure form of stanza?
Well, I just think that the couplet, whether it rhymes or not, is the building block. Because one line by itself, I don't ever think of as a stanza. But I think when I begin to put two lines together, I begin to think about the relationship between those two lines and then the relationship between those lines and the next two lines and then among each other.
Okay.
And no two lines together form a complete whole, I don't think. So in that sense, I think that they're a building block to something bigger. And whether or not I leave a poem as just a set of two-line stanzas, or I go with quatrains or something like that. I think I'd like to say that it's dictated by the poem, but it's probably often not. It's probably my decision just to say, okay, well, what happens if I do this in groups of four? When I write a poem, I don't write it in stanzas. I write it in something that looks like a prose paragraph. And then I break it up. And I will, in each poem's file, I will have it in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And compare and see how the couplets compare to the, you know, to the longer stanzas. And I just trust my intuition whether how I decide to leave it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that has to do with the poem. I'm sure you're not saying these must be couplets. I'm sure it has to do with the poem.
Well, you know? I mean, you'll see some of them. Like if I have other poems where the last line doesn't have a partner,
right.
I don't know. Sometimes I count what I will do first before I break it into stanzas is I'll count how many lines I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not too proud to say that I've just sometimes divided by three or fours just to see what happens. I mean, I'll start with that. I won't just let mathematics determine my stanzas, but
I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
Okay.
You know,
good.
You know, I think everybody does that. It's like, okay, what happens if I make it into tercets? Mm. Oh, I'm going to have these two hanging off here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
I like how that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think
it does things to the poem that I wouldn't, that in my sense, with my sense of control, I wouldn't normally do. I'm much more concerned about how I break a line as opposed to how I group stanzas.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Yeah. This is a poem that, for me, is mostly about sound. Also, it's a childhood poem, but it's called Childhood Staccato, and I love thinking about sound in a poem, and this is a piece that, for me, is about an experience that was all about sound. Childhood Staccato. A fall remembered as sound, not an ache or scrape of skin on metal, but as coins tumbling in wonder and confusion from a child's pocket, pennies bouncing heads and tails down cellar stairs without resistance. Like a leaf in the current, a fish on the banks, cast from suck and flow, she had to learn detachment sometime. If I could just go back for a second, we talked about stanzas. The way that this stanza ends, which people can't see by just listening to me, is that last line, detachment sometime, is actually detached from the poem. That doesn't have a
mm-hmm.
partner.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a serendipitous thing when I began to break it into stanzas. I brought a couple ekphrastic poems that are written about art. And I like to work with my creative writing students to get them to unlock and confront things in their own lives, which they might not normally feel comfortable doing when they're writing poetry in an undergraduate class. And I will give them an image or collection of images and have them triangulate themselves between an experience that they have had and the experience of looking at a poem and then the words on the page. So I encourage them to look at an image, think about how they feel about that physically, emotionally, in the abstract, and then connect that in the specific to something that they have experienced and get a poem out of that. This first one is called A Consideration of Modesty While Viewing Frisica's Summer. Only if I were alone could I lie naked under the green wood by the lost stream, arms over my head, knees carelessly bent but close together, but I am not as beautiful or unashamed as she. Only if I closed my eyes to prize the blue-white pearls of sweat looped around my twisting neck, that morning might waltz across my half-lit skin. Only at night, the dark current warm and green, the moon rising deliberately over the unbroken line, where heaven and horizon whisper their silent greed. This is called Girl with a Red Hat, after a Vermeer painting. And I was particularly attracted to this piece because of her expressions. Doesn't seem to be as calm as many of the other women in his paintings. Girl with Red Hat. She knows the social graces, legs crossed at the ankle, teacup balanced on cambered knee, little finger curled like a comma at the end of a trembling hand. He frightens her. Can't he see that? The studio smells like roses and sandalwood, lemon and wet wool, subject and painter. She could be his daughter. For her, he will pick wildflowers from the field behind the churchyard, gossip softly about affairs of state, and when he leaves for the evening, touch her blushing cheek and quickly back away. This is called Comfort Me with Apples. Again, tightening, release, queasiness I felt as a child, visual perception as a foundation. This is what makes things attainable. Apples on the windowsill, rotting from the inside out, give birth to flies. I hear only their banter when I stop what I am typing. One must have patience in the growing season, but it's summer. Obsession defines me. I want you to be someone in whom I can confide, graft myself onto. As the apple among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the suns. But your fruit softens, sours. The splinter works its way out, though I still feel it deep in the muscle of my palm. Here under the apple tree where my mother brought me forth, I have fallen hard from the highest branch, recovered myself, counted the apples I have tasted. Baldwin, delicious, northern spy, nature's windfall, thousands left uneaten, recommitted to the wild. They are silent now, the woman, the passion, the air around me. Even Homer shunned discord, but she crashed the wedding anyway, threw an apple to the bridesmaids, and toward it they dove, scattering the seeds of a happy ending. This is a very wintry poem. I know what you will say before you say it. January, pale from lack of sun. I speak without sound, my hands through the air, with speed and interval in shapes that prove my name, the names of others, only as a sum of their parts. An alphabet carved of handshake, fist, pointed finger. Accusations caress the air like paper stroked by pen, a lexicon revealed in code. I am happy, although you are with her between the hillside and the ocean. Still, it plagues and heals me. The whisker you missed shaving high on your cheekbone that afternoon we took a walk down a gravel road to say goodbye. This is language I treasure. The tally of a ledger, animals owned or hunted, shell and bone of daily occupation. I am money. Spend me wisely.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Arlen Hess, reading from her manuscript, The Etymology of Autumn. Arlen, one thing I love about your work is this, what feels to me like an underpinning of romanticism in your work. And even though all the poems are not like, happy ending kind of poems, but, I mean, you have great lines like, from one of the ones you read, such as the momentary consolation of kindness. And I keep feeling that sense of compassion all through your work. Can you talk about how you feel about that, or choices you've made in your craft to support that?
I'm not a big fan of the romantics, but I will take that as a compliment. You mean romantic with a capital R?
I mean in the very large sense of...
Oh, yeah, I would call myself a romantic in that sense.
Yeah.
I worry about my poems sometimes sounding too brokenhearted. I think I'm a lot lighter than a lot of my work is.
Well, I mean, you're not your work, right?
Am I not? I mean, it's a part of me. It's not all of me.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I mean...
Yeah, I don't like my lighter poems, like mm-hmm. my garden poems. Not great stuff. Don't mm-hmm. not happy about that. I feel like a poem should have some gravitas mm-hmm. to it. I had somebody read my work once. A friend, when I was in grad school, we were sharing work. We were trying to be each other's first readers for a while. And he told me that he thought I sounded like a victim in my poems. Mm-hmm. And I really disagreed with him, and we stopped sharing work after that.
Good.
I can write those kind of poems, and I can write really high light poems as well. Mm-hmm. But the kind of work that I come back to over and over again, that I can reread over again and not feel embarrassed that I wrote it, is work that really seems to show a struggle with living the everyday and working through the things that life throws at us, the breakups, the little car accidents, the falling down the stairs when I'm a little girl, you know, those kinds of things. And those memories stay with us too.
Yeah.
And when I have a memory that has stayed with me for a long period of time or a regret, I try to write a poem about it. I try to get it into words.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, when I said an underpinning of romanticism, I mean, I meant that as a compliment.
Oh, no, I took it that way. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know you wouldn't try to say that something that I wasn't. No, I mean, of course, somebody could tell me I, you know, sounded like Justin Bieber, and I would take this compliment. You know, for whatever reason, I wouldn't be insulted by something that somebody said.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's wonderful layering in your work, and there is gravitas and a sense of compassion that comes through, like you just said, about the struggle of humanity. I don't think you're a master of selling your work. I mean, I feel like...
I'm not.
You tell us everything that could be not right. And but it's probably, you know, I don't know. I just... that's another issue, but I just want to...
I'll try to be better.
No, I'm just praising what I see, and I think there's some great stuff here.
I was going to say that I'm always really fascinated about how people perceive my work.
Yeah.
And I take the fact that they think about it at all is a compliment.
Okay, well, can you read some more poems?
Yeah. This is called Guatemala, and it was written from an experience I had in March of 1998. At Quirigua, a boy in high tops and jeans beside a Mayan temple and ancient field hawks a stone relic for $20. I know he scratched the piece himself to scam American tourists, their buses emptied and reloaded since dawn, and by noon he carried more cash in his pocket than I did, but I am shamed by his persistence and barter $5 for the rock. The money doesn't matter. He proffers lies to strangers, so every cent is gain. But hypnotized by blue monarchs and fire ants in the jungle, what I buy is a self-consciousness. I suffer like a pebble in my shoe all afternoon, recalling how some mornings a stranger's face appears in my window and dry leaves in August sound like rain. I see myself as he sees me, an easy mark who believes all she hears. He'll cheat me again, as will others like him. So I'll make room for this artless lump and confine to my shelf its patterns of outrage and blame. This is called Elephant of Surprise. And the title comes from how we sometimes mishear what other people say, because that happens in the poem. Elephant of Surprise. Monday morning, when you confess you are feeling out of control, I think you say, I am knitting ears of gold. And I remember just then why I never played hide and seek as a child. Wonder is only tolerable when one knows where to step over buckled seams in the carpet, or when to tiptoe around the coffee table en route to the unlit kitchen. The grooves and paths we carve for ourselves through landscapes we understand. Under one roof, a manifestation of ancestors, Blanche, daughter of Mary, Mary, daughter of Margaret, Margaret, daughter of Helen. When we are small, fear wiggles in the palm of a hand. Light switches on opposite walls predict the way into and out of rooms, but we can't light our way into death, cross the years and extinguish birth as we slip into an unknown of our own making. Truth is, I prefer night more than I favor the dark. Truth is the bird brooding her only egg. This one is called Jude. Behind closed eyes, the child knows but cannot recognize the pressure and suck of muscle that pulls him into being, the harmony of two notes as they spread through one body, the rings of Jupiter, the gale that twists above its clouds 300 years in the spinning. Swaddled in fog, thick as an infant universe, the child weeps for the music of his mother's breast, silently at first, then oscillating, an expansion of sound radial as a ringing bell. What he cannot see patterns his life. The sun's one motion, cliff, tide, and stag moons, waters flow from mountain to ocean, where it ebbs and fades, only to again pour down as rain upon the crest of the rise. I will tell you what your father won't. Waves are the skin of the water. The willow, true to its nature, will shelter and give shade. Through leaves, I see headlights speed through the intersection. Drivers pass the house but don't look up. Everyone has somewhere to go. This morning, you are in Moscow selling carnations in the square, making art, you call it. Not a sad song, but an effect of the new moon on a rising and falling wave.
The poetry of Arlen Hess. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.